Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we'll hear from former North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat, and former North Dakota Governor Ed Schaefer, a Republican. The two will give their insight into civility in these charged political times. They spoke last week at Concordia College as part of a panel discussion titled With Malice Towards None, a conversation about civility, the common good, and the future of the American dream. But first, co-hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast host Dr. Robert Gabby, Chief Scientific and Medical Officer for the American Diabetes Association. The topics include weight loss drugs, current diabetes technology, and needed access to healthcare for those who suffer from or are likely to suffer from diabetes. The conversation begins with host Mark Maselli asking Dr. Gabby about current statistics about diabetes that many may not know about.
But I wanted to start off with some facts that I don't think many Americans know, that the cost of diabetes to the U.S. healthcare system is over $400 billion a year, and that 1 in 7 American adults have type 2 diabetes, now up from 1 in 20 in the 1970s. I want to start off, though, with the cost of insulin. There's a Medicare cap on the cost of insulin, and 25 states in the Washington, D.C. have cost limits on insulin. But what about the rest of the country? What can and should be done to make sure that all Americans have equal access to these reduced prices?
The American Diabetes Association has really been engaged over the last several years in ensuring that all people that need insulin have access to insulin. And so that battle has taken us a lot of different places. As you mentioned, we've been successful in many states from the Medicare perspective, but we still need more work to be done to extend it to all states and ultimately for all payers. And we continue to engage in the efforts to ensure people have access to insulin.
Well, Dr. Gabay, let's talk about some of your recent updates. Your association has updates on cardiovascular health for people living with diabetes, including some new screening recommendations for heart failure. Tell us about these changes. How are they going to help with the overall wellness of this population?
You know, one of the things that we know is that people with diabetes are at greater risk for heart failure, and we now have new treatments that can prevent any progression of the earliest form of disease. And so as a result of that, we've made recommendations for those individuals that are at high risk for developing heart failure. In other words, they might have type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, lipid cholesterol issues. Those individuals should get screened with a blood test. It's a relatively simple blood test, BNP. And based on that, you can tell whether somebody may actually have heart failure and evaluate them further.
You know, there are a lot of new words that get added to the English language each year. I think Ozempic falls into that category of new words. And it's really one of the biggest pieces of recent diabetes news has obviously been the approval of injectable weight loss drugs such as Ozempic. They're leading to a reduction in blood sugar levels. I wonder if you could share with our audience what the latest research on these drugs is and what's your view on their use?
Well, there really have been a very exciting new entry into the ways of managing individuals with diabetes and helping them achieve their goals. And we know that weight is so critical for most people with type 2 diabetes. But honestly, even for people with type 1 diabetes, about a quarter of them live with obesity as well. And obesity leads to all sorts of potential complications, not only worsening diabetes, but increasing the risk of heart disease, sleep apnea, a whole series of other issues. Up until recently, the only medical treatments that we've had, you know, we've certainly had lifestyle, and that continues to be important. And the only medical treatments we've had have maybe resulted in, you know, 5-7% weight loss. And then these newer medications come on the market and they result in anywhere, you know, from like 15% weight loss or higher, something almost what we previously had seen with surgical options. And so they've really been an important tool in helping to manage diabetes.
Is there any shortage of Ozempic and that type of drug right now? Maybe you could talk about that. And I know it's also off off-label being used in different parts of the world?
We are been monitoring the supply chain and the availability of these medications because there has been a big demand for them. This seems to be getting better as time goes on, and the hope is that anyone who needs and would benefit from these medications would have access to them.
Well, Dr. Gabe, you've written, and I think I'm quoting here, that obesity is included in the litany of chronic diseases that plague 6 in 10 Americans, except by Medicare, which consistently refuses to cover treatment for obesity until it causes significant health problems like diabetes or heart disease. I have a feeling you've given a lot of thought to this issue, so take a moment and fill us in on your perspective. And do you see this changing as Medicare seems to be committed to continuing to work towards a more preventive-oriented agenda?
It really is important that we try to get upstream of diseases. We know that obesity is a disease. It's a big driver to the increasing numbers of people developing diabetes. And it's important that people have access to treatments that are effective. And at least at this point, Medicare is not covering those treatments. And that's something we've been advocating for.
And it would seem that we would have the same issue with Medicaid, and hopefully at a much younger age, since Medicaid is the primary public insurance for children. And certainly the issues of obesity in children are very paramount in our prevention agenda. Anything that you're doing in that area to focus on the school-age children, for instance?
Well, school-age children are another group to be considering. There's really an opportunity with them to do a number of lifestyle interventions that can really be beneficial. And we'd like to see more of that spread across the country.
Well, I want to pick up on your theme of access to treatment. And certainly you understand that in here in the community health center movement, school-based health services, access to care is very important. And also for racial and ethnic groups, some very troubling data points that Black Americans are 60% more likely to be diagnosed with diabetes by their provider than white adults. And Blacks with diabetes are 3 to 4 times more likely to have a limb amputated than a white person with the same conditions. The rate of amputation seems to be getting worse. I wonder if you could just describe what initiatives are underway to address these disparities.
It's an incredibly important issue that the American Diabetes Association has really leaned in. And over the last several years, we started with really a call for health equity now. And as part of that, a Bill of Rights that really speak to everybody having access to the things that help them live healthy with their diabetes, whether that is medications, technology, screening tests, and healthy food. You know, many of these statistics that you describe are driven in part by the zip code people live in and the availability of care, healthy foods, safe exercise. And so all of those things have been areas where we've been working a great deal. On the issue of amputation, I'm glad that you brought that up because most people don't realize that that's one of the few complications of diabetes. It's actually getting worse. We've made progress on many others, but not around amputation. And so in our standards of care, the global guidelines for diabetes, we've also included information about early screening for peripheral arterial disease, one of the reasons why people may get amputations, and working effectively in that area to really identify people early to prevent amputations.
Dr. Gabe, I have to say, you're just making a great case for people need access to really excellent primary care. It's screening for the peripheral arterial disease, for the retinopathy, for the kidney disease, for nutrition education and counseling. Thanks for making that so clear. We have just got to do something about those increasing rates of amputation. But tied into all these concerns, and I think it's another area where we see a real disparity between people based on, as you say, the zip code, perhaps as a marker for economics and education and access to resources. But it's the need for access to the best diabetes technology that we have today. It's certainly an example of that that many people are familiar with is continuous glucose monitoring and being able to maybe do that remotely with your results being channeled to your primary care provider. I know you and others are involved in this initiative to make it more widespread where appropriate. How is this working, again, particularly from a racial equity viewpoint?
We've had some success, but we honestly have more to do. One of the first steps, you know, in coverage for technology is really derives out of our standards of care and providing the evidence. And so last year, we made the unequivocal statement that anybody with diabetes on insulin, whether they're a child, an adult, or an older adult, should have access and availability of a continuous glucose monitor. As a result of that, we were successful in getting Medicare coverage, and we were really pleased about that for those populations. And now we've been working state by state with Medicaid, which, to your point, is really the mechanism that we can address the inequities in terms of access to treatment. The other thing I'll sort of point out is we've been doing a lot of educational efforts, targeting primary care in particular to ensure that they're comfortable with the technology, with interpreting the results, and be able to guide their patients to manage their diabetes effectively.
You know, I want to pick up on your theme earlier about complications with diabetes. And while Americans wish that COVID was in our rearview mirror, it is here, still with us and quite prevalent. But there are serious complications that can arise if one gets COVID and has diabetes. Maybe talk a little bit about that. Also about the research that's needed in this area, particularly around the issues around long COVID and the others. Sort of a waterfront of issues to handle there. But I think for most Americans, COVID is still very present somewhere in their community or within their families.
We've been fortunate that things are better than they were, but at its peak, COVID pandemic really devastated the diabetes community. At one point, as many as 40% of the deaths were with people living with diabetes. And so really staggering. Individuals with diabetes, when they develop COVID, tend to do much worse, much more likely to be hospitalized, increased mortality, all of that. And then the other interesting piece that has been evolving is whether COVID itself may lead to the development of diabetes. Yeah. And there have been some studies seeing an increase in type 1 diabetes and also in type 2 diabetes. So that's an area that needs to be further studied, how the virus itself may be causing diabetes. And again, as you started this program with the rising numbers of individuals developing diabetes, the last thing we need is anything fueling that further.
Is Paxlovid sort of drug of choice at that point if somebody with diabetes gets it? And are you looking at any of these, maybe talk a little bit about long-term COVID and its potential treatment, metformin, other things that might be being used in treating this?
Paxlovid certainly is something indicated for people with diabetes developing COVID because they are at much higher risk for more dangerous complications of COVID infection. So that is very much a recommendation. Long COVID is something that we're still honestly defining and in many ways really trying to understand how common it is. But early studies suggest that people with diabetes are once again more likely to develop long COVID. All the more reason to avoid infection and then treat that infection with Paxlovid.
Dr. Gabay, I want to pick up my theme again around the importance of the routine screenings in diabetes care that we know are so important, often pose access barriers for many people. And one of them is certainly in the prevention of blindness. I think people perhaps in years past thought it was inevitable that there might be loss of vision in diabetes, but we know that with early detection, we can actually remedy that. And of course, we need to talk about artificial intelligence and its role in all of this. So tell us about the emerging artificial intelligence technology and the role it might play in eye screenings, which is so important. And can this eye screening take place in routine primary care?
Very important issue. You know, diabetes continues to be a leading cause of blindness, and it is largely preventable. And how do you prevent it? It's really catching it early. And how do you catch it early? Yearly eye exam. And despite that being very clear, only about 60% of people living with diabetes get a yearly eye exam. So everything we can do to make that more accessible and more available is really important. Having that done in primary care with retinal cameras is one way to be able to do that. The technology is really advanced to be able to take a picture of the eye and be able to diagnose early disease and then refer somebody to ensure that they don't lose their sight. And the technology is now advanced with artificial intelligence to be able to read those retinal images effectively. closely and be able to tell significant disease versus you sort of have it all clear and just come back next year for that eye exam. The FDA has now approved several technologies that use AI to interpret those retinal photographs. And our hope is, and our recommendations and our standards of care were that those are an effective tool to be able to use to increase the number of people that get eye exams done, particularly to your point, in primary care, where most people with diabetes get their care.
The intervention for diabetes is really sort of being reframed in a much broader context. And the Federal Commission on Diabetes recently delivered a national report to Congress on diabetes. And it was really the first of its kind in 50 years. And what was interesting is that, as I said, it reframes the diabetes epidemic as social, economic, and environmental problems, and not just health issues. The experts suggest improving access to healthy foods and rethinking transportation networks are part of the answer. I'm wondering how the ADA feels about this larger reframing and maybe any initiatives that you have going on that might address some of these areas outside of the four walls of the medical office, which are very important. Come on in for your primary care, but also where you live, breathe, pray, and enjoy life is also important.
Very much so. And diabetes, probably more than any other disease, is so dependent on what the individual living with diabetes does in terms of their self-management. And helping them to do that is really the role of the healthcare system. And at the same time, they're only seeing their healthcare professional once every 2 or 3 months. So what happens during all that time in between? It's all the decisions that they need to make on their health. And part of that really falls onto this broader area that is often referred to as the social determinants of health. And it turns out that those social determinants, where you live, poverty, access to healthy foods, safe places to exercise, transportation to go to your appointments, all of those things turn out to be as important as what the healthcare system delivers. And so there's been interesting work where healthcare systems have engaged in community interventions. And we at the American Diabetes Association have been doing that in a number of communities in Chicago, working to ensure access to healthy foods. For many of these individuals that we've been partnering with, it's the first time they're really having access to fresh vegetables and then teaching them what to do with them, because sadly, this is not something that they've had access for. So really, really important issue.
Dr. Gabay, I'd like to give you a chance to maybe shine a spotlight on an annual research report of the ADA that highlighted efforts to improve outcomes specifically for the deaf community living with diabetes through some specially designed programs. Tell us about that.
We fund a great deal of research and have, I think, 171 active grants that we are managing right now. And one of them is a really exciting one by an investigator, Michelle Lichtman, who is solving the problem of individuals with hearing loss. And how do they learn about diabetes? And it turns out there's a huge gap there. They tend to do far worse with their diabetes than individuals that have normal hearing. And because of the communication, because of the understanding, they may or may not know sign language. There really needs to be better ways to reach out to them. And this research project has been developing those tools to help that community.
Such an important issue. You know, you were talking earlier about social determinants of health, and really want to talk a little bit about the mind-body relationship with diabetes. And people with diabetes are 20% more likely to experience anxiety than people without diabetes. And 40% of people with diabetes have said they have struggled with their psychological well-being since being diagnosed. I'm wondering how the ADA is addressing these psychological issues to go along with the physical ones.
Well, one of the important ways we've been doing that, just from Margaret's last question, is around supporting research. Each year we target different areas to make our investments. And one of the big areas over the last year has really been about mental health. So those statistics are really concerning. It also turns out that about a third of people with type 2 diabetes are at risk for depression as well. And we know that individuals with diabetes that have any of these mental health issues tend to do a lot worse. So thinking through the interventions that can be done to help, we've also established a mental health directory to help healthcare professionals, as well as people living with diabetes, find a mental health person that they can work with to be able to address their issues.
Well, Dr. Gabe, we've had a chance to talk about the very important work that ADA is doing around prevention, around helping people live better lives with diabetes, about preventing the complications. I'm thinking, you know, this year brought us the big news around sickle cell disease and the hope of a cure through CRISPR technology and some of the things that we look forward to playing a greater role in the future. Would you like to take a moment to tell us, is there anything on the horizon undergoing research that looks at a cure for diabetes at this point?
Very exciting period right now, and probably the most promising and something that's been active research for a number of years is the idea of being able to replace the cells that are either destroyed in type 1 diabetes or not functioning appropriately in type 2 diabetes, the insulin-producing cells. There's now the ability to take a blood sample, isolate those blood cells, and devolve them into stem cells, and then grow them into insulin-producing cells, then potentially transplanting them into individuals. And that's happened with some early success. And the next level of problem to solve is dealing with the immune system, that these cells would not get destroyed. And to your point, one of the technologies that's being used is actually CRISPR technology, identifying what it is on those insulin-producing cells that attracts the immune system, and can you alter that cell surface so that it won't be recognized as something to destroy and allow these cells to thrive, continue to produce insulin, and not require people to take immunosuppressive drugs that have the downsides of just broadly suppressing the immune system.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get to where you are today?
Really, for me, professionally, I've been in the diabetes world my entire professional career, and I started as a basic scientist working in the laboratory, trying to understand how insulin signaled at the cell level. Finishing my PhD, I realized that I wanted to have a greater impact in a more applied and direct way. And so I went to medical school and became an endocrinologist over time and treating patients. And I still see patients at my former institution, the Joslin Diabetes Center. I led before coming to the American Diabetes Association. And for me, it's really about how to have an impact on as many people as possible. And that's the wonderful thing that the American Diabetes Association does. We fund research towards a cure, towards solutions to help people in the here and now. We advocate for people living with diabetes, and we engage the healthcare professionals to guide them on how to deliver the best possible care, and lots of programs from establishing what those benchmarks and clinical guidelines are and our standards of care, to educating and working directly with clinicians to help them change their practice to deliver care better. One of the ways that your audience can engage with the American Diabetes Association is through our website, diabetes.org, where there's a wealth of information on a lot of what we've talked about, how to live healthy with diabetes and a kind of research we're doing and all of the things that we've been talking about. In addition, an opportunity if they want to support this important mission so we can do even more to help people living with diabetes and those at risk.
Speaking of support, and you're down in the Washington, D.C. area, Congress is still haven't passed a budget. What are the implications for diabetes research and treatment, and where should people be looking to focus in on, in addition to the monies that come to the ADA, where is the bolus of dollars in the federal budget?
One area that we've been advocating and we continue to is really around research funding, and that is largely through the National Institute of Health that has the sort of largest opportunity to fund diabetes research. It tends to be more at the basic level, and then there's the Center for Disease Control that has many programs to help people with diabetes and also to prevent the development of diabetes. And so advocate for increased funding in to those agencies that can really make a difference.
That was Dr. Robert Gabby with host Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner from an episode of the Conversations on Healthcare podcast. Coming up, civility. It's a needed conversation. That's next.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The question why is very empowering. It's about the divine, it's about the moral, it's about the pleasurable, it's about fear. Why is everything? I'm not very good with authority and I'm not very good with limits. And so I like a question that gives me the ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want. I was born and raised in Manhattan on the edge of a neighborhood that most people would know as Spanish Harlem. I ended up in North Dakota because they offered me a job. It's that simple. And we've had a very good life here so far. Dispel these myths. Philosophy is boring. I guess I would ask you to ask yourself, are you boring? Do you think you have nothing of interest to offer anybody? You are philosophy. Philosophy is you. Everything you ask, everything you think, everything you want, everything you strive for, this is what makes up philosophy. Philosophy itself is compelling enough and exciting enough that it is pretty much the oldest discipline. And philosophers had more influence on the world than almost anybody. Plato, Aristotle, we live in their world. And so if you want to make philosophy exciting, you have to be exciting. Philosophy majors can't get jobs or make any money. Philosophy is the highest paid major of all of the humanities, and the rate of return is actually the same over a lifetime as engineering. Listen to Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life every second Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In a time where political divisions seem insurmountable, we're bringing you a conversation that not only seeks to bridge these divides, but also to inspire civility and collaboration for the common good. Our segment today is centered around an enlightening discussion that took place at Concordia College, featuring two distinguished guests, former North Dakota U.S. Senator Heidi Heitkamp and former North Dakota Governor Ed Schaefer. One's a Democrat, one's a Republican. Both have a rich history of public service and a commitment to working across the aisle to build a better society. Let's dive into their insights on overcoming political polarization and working towards a unified future. So let's set the stage. Dean Sonia Wedling of the School of Arts and Sciences at Concordia College opened the evening with a warm welcome, highlighting the careers of Heitkamp and Schaefer, both of whom have exemplified the spirit of bipartisan cooperation. Heitkamp's efforts towards improving the lives of Indigenous people, working families, and securing affordable health care, along with Schaefer's work in diversifying North Dakota's economy and promoting agriculture, set the backdrop for a rich discussion on civility and the common good. Senator Heitkamp takes the podium first, stressing the importance of showing students and the community that a friendly, productive political relationship across party lines is not only possible, but essential. She reflects on her own surprise election as North Dakota's first female senator, attributing her success to her focus on the people over party lines. Heitkamp passionately talks about the challenges of political tribalism and the need for civic engagement to counteract the divisiveness plaguing American politics.
Thank you all for this warm welcome. When people ask me, why are you doing this? Why did you come? I said, because so many students on campuses like this have never seen a legitimate, honest, and friendly political relationship across the aisle. The only thing that they have seen in their history has been a lot of rancor, a lot of disagreement, and a lot of mean-spirited back and forth. And so I thought it's just so important that we remind ourselves, as the adults in the room, that things don't have to be this way, that things can, in fact, change, because they change so rapidly from, you know, even the time when Ed and I were in office, you know, I guess now it's 20 years ago, 24 years ago, Ed. But the example that I give about where we are is how North Dakota has changed. I tell people, when I was elected to the United States Senate, no one thought I was going to get elected. I kind of thought I had a shot, but for full disclosure, I was pretty shocked on election night that I might have won. The forum didn't predict it, right, Jack? You kind of missed that one. But I can't resist. I saw you there. I couldn't resist. You should have sat further back, and then it would have been too dark. The lights would have been in my eye. But I tell you this story because when I ran, the reason why national pundits didn't think I could get elected is because they knew Barack Obama was going to lose the state by at least 22 points. If he could win by something less than that, they thought maybe I had a shot. But 22 points, that was just too big of a partisan political headwind. Well, Barack Obama lost North Dakota by 22 points, and I won election to the United States Senate. So at that point in time, people were looking at electing or voting for the person. Elect not for a political party, not for a slogan, but actually voting for the person. When I ran for re-election 6 years later, and these are important 6 years politically, that number was 4. And Donald Trump won North Dakota by a percentage higher than any other state in the union except 3 in North Dakota. And so it was clear that something had happened to tribalize our politics. And it made it less, I think, politically available to work across the aisle, to be compromisers, to actually do the work of governing. We were in that spot where it didn't matter if you produced 2 farm bills or if you did opened up oil exports or whatever it was that we wanted to brag about that we had done during that time period. None of that mattered. What mattered is whether you belonged to the right tribe and whether you were flying the colors and being loyal. And so I'm saying it's wrong to vote your political party. That's not wrong. But it also has created a dynamic in this country that has left, in some degree, the people behind. Because the people we go to represent as public officials are the people who are the loudest, the maybe most extreme of our political discussion. And it has driven the narrative. It has made it okay to say really mean things. And if you get that viral moment that you can then fundraise off, it becomes even a competition to see who can get the most numbers of clicks or who can get the most amount of attention on social media. And it has denigrated our political discourse. And we now are at a spot where, how do we fix this? Because right now in America, if you ask people, are they satisfied with the state of the politics in this country, 70% of the people are disgusted by what's going on and feel powerless to change it. And the only way it can change is by broad civic engagement, by good people stepping up. We talked all day, Ed and I did, about, what are the solutions to this problem? How do we fix this problem? And what we've been saying over and over and over again is as the mean, loud voices get louder, the good people are retreating. The good people are saying, I don't want to be part of that. I only have so much bandwidth in my life. I'm raising my kids. I'm helping with my grandkids. I'm trying to put food on the table. I'm trying to do all the things that we all need to do. And I don't have time if it's not going to have value, if it's not going to change anything. And so one of the reasons why we do these programs is to encourage people not to step back, but to step up. To begin that process of engaging, yes, social media, a cesspool of meanness, right? But what happens when 20 people get on the same social media platform and say something nice or say something that clarifies points of view? What happens if you become truth tellers on social media? A lot of times those loud voices retreat. They don't want to be challenged in a way where they look foolish. And so we are doing this program, and if you had told me 5 years ago that I'd be affiliated with an academic institution, I would have said that's the last thing I want to do with my time. But I chose that as a kind of second career because I believe that it is so important that we model behaviors, that we encourage critical thinking, but we also encourage civil discourse and dialogue among young people, wherever we can find it, wherever young people are gathered, to model those behaviors. Because if we don't, if all young people and students at institutions like this see is the rancor and the anger and the meanness, they're not only going to step back, they are going to run back. And so, you know, I tell people I am the daughter of someone who was part of the greatest generation. And the greatest generation took on the greatest challenge ever seen in the history of the world. The Nazis, the Axis, the Japanese, the autocrats who would take over the world with horrible, horrible intentions and ideas. But yet we band together in this country and across the world, good people of good intentions to fight back. We are so good in this country defeating external threats. The last time we were unified in this country was after 9/11. Because that was a threat on all of us. Because we found our common American identity. We found our common American purpose. It is so much harder to find that common American purpose when the threat in our democracy is ourselves. It's internal. It is what do we do about where we are today? How do we, and it's not them versus us, it's us versus us. And how do we reach across the aisle? How do we have that civil discourse that will lead to a more perfect union? The divisions in this country have been fanned by bad politics. Because what motivates people more than fear? Fear of the other. Fear of the guy next door, fear of the person coming to this country who just wants to have a better life because they may look different from you. Fear motivates our politics and it sells. It's so much easier than inspiration. How do you fix that? Don't vote for fear. Vote for people who inspire you, who have the best ideas. And you may say, where do I find them? Because I've looked up and down that ballot and I haven't found anybody who has inspired me. We need to make sure that we're not just voting in those general elections, but we are voting and stepping up. And guess what? Someone in this room could be the next inspirational leader. Someone in this room could move our country forward. A young person could be the next governor of North Dakota with the idea of bringing people together and not dividing people. We, the people, are the only people who are going to fix this. Do not look to Washington. Really? Would anyone look to Washington for solutions? The solutions are in communities like this. They're in campuses across the country. They're in your own backyard. We talked to students today, and they said, well, how can we participate? And I said, start by talking to each other. Start by building the skill of dialogue and conversation and communication, and don't be afraid to take on the tough issues. It helps you build character, it helps you build critical thinking, and it helps you build the skills that you'll need to be good at whatever you decide to do, whether it's politics or whether it is religion. You have to have the ability to talk to people and listen to people.
Governor Schaefer next shares his journey, humorously noting his series of former titles, but emphasizing the serious need for civility in political engagement. He recalls lessons learned from his political career, the importance of staying true to oneself, and the need to focus on the good of the people over party politics. Schaefer's story of bipartisan cooperation, exemplified by Senators Dole and McGovern, serves as a powerful reminder of the potential for unity in service of a greater cause.
Really, it's always a fun opportunity to be with Heidi, have a little political discourse, have some friendship, and share some good memories. So thanks for the opportunity to get together. Sonia You mentioned that I'm a former president and a former secretary and a former governor. It's kind of like I couldn't hold a job, right? I actually have a grandson that calls me former. As we kind of set up this conversation about civility and the willingness to engage in the public process, I thought I'd give you a couple of examples or a couple of things that were messages to me or learning experiences for me in how to kind of navigate that really difficult situation of the badness of politics. Is that a word? The unfortunate anger and difficulty and challenge and fighting in the political party. And one of the things that I learned is when I got in office is there's a big difference between getting elected, which is politics, and moving to the politics of performance, which is after you're there. And one of the things that worked well for Heidi and myself is when our political party, we weren't running for the same office at the same time, but our political parties were certainly engaged in a negative way with each other, pounding on each other. We didn't know about it in 92 because we didn't have the social media out there. But it was, you know, it was a difficult, ugly time. And what happened is that when we came together and were elected, the focus shifted not for the political party or who brought you here or what they did, but it shifted to what's best for the people of North Dakota. What's best for the mission at hand, and how do we relate that not to our political party or our political philosophy, but what happens to the people? Because as Heidi mentioned, we are a people-driven government and should be. A couple of lessons I learned along the way. After this difficult, I wasn't supposed to win either, by the way. And she talked about 22 points down. After the primary in North Dakota in June, I was 22 points in the hole against my opponent. Gave him a lot of false security. But I was running for office. And the thing that was important to me at the time was, how are you going to perform? How are you going to get the job done? It wasn't a fun time. Politicians are pretty competitive. Things were negative. The better I did, the worse it got on the other side. But you know what? The first person who called me after the election, after I was elected, the first person who called me was a person who had written letters to the editor about how bad I was, how awful I was, and if I would get elected, the state would go down the tubes. It was Governor Art Link. And Governor Art Link called me first thing, and if you knew Art Link, it was, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning. I think I just went to bed, actually. You know, his comment was, look, it wasn't advice about how to run the state or what to do. He said, just stay with who you are. Stand for who you are. Don't get sidetracked by headlines or polls or letters to the editor or your opposition or special interest groups. Be true to who you are and govern the best way you can for the good of the people. Really solid advice. Keeping that in mind after the election, and Heidi and I ended up on the Industrial Commission in the state of North Dakota, which is a pretty powerful government board. You know, we didn't have to represent our parties anymore. We had to represent the people of North Dakota and the Bank of North Dakota and the state mill and other important institutions, the oil and gas development and things in the state of North Dakota. So our mission was, how do we do this together? How do we get this done? And that changed the relationship out of the rancor, the politics, into the performance aspect of being there. We were both reelected in those jobs, and Heidi talked about when she first ran for Senate, you know, that things were different politically, but I'm convinced when Heidi wasn't supposed to win, she won because of her performance. She won because she did the job. She won because people understood that she cared about the government, that she directed good government, and she delivered good government for the people of North Dakota. That's why she won, not because of all the political money and the, you know, changes. I mean, it was the performance of the people. And if you keep in mind the people, I think you can stay away from the political rancor that takes place all the time. Now, let me give you another example that I have that I think is hugely important about Republicans and Democrats working together. In 2008, when I was Secretary of Agriculture, the World Food Prize is given annually to someone who has been hugely influential globally in nutrition or in agriculture. In 2008, the World Food Prize was given to two people, Senator Bob Dole and Senator George McGovern, together. The interesting thing was, you know, strong Democrat, strong Republican, both well-known nationally, both strong leaders, but they were given this World Food Prize because of the work they did for nutrition for kids, because they championed not only changes in nutrition programs and WIC programs and food programs for kids in North Dakota, school lunches and school breakfasts, after school programs, they championed, but they did globally. And they talked about how, you know, when hungry kids don't learn, you know, we need in these foreign countries to put programs together to feed people, to get them into school, to get them learning, to get them educated, and how important that was. But the most important thing to me in that ceremony was when the two of them were called up to the stage to accept the award. They stood at the podium, and the first thing they did was sing, "Jesus Loves the Little Children." They accepted the award, they went back down, and of course the Democrats were sitting on one side of the chambers, the Republicans were sitting on the other side of the chambers, but when all the applause was done, everything was quieted, they reached across the aisle and they held hands. That is what leadership is all about. And so that's been inspiring to me ever since about the way that we deal with people, the way that we try to forge public policy for the good of everyone, not just the political party or whatever. Because, and we all can kind of take this stuff too seriously. You know, I mean, it's a good idea to be humble out there, to say, well, we have a job to do, but, you know, the end of the world isn't going to be there if I don't get my job done, or if I don't get elected or whatever. We have a strong system. It's resilient. It's capable. And it can be driven forward in a good and happy manner.
As we listen to these narratives, it's clear that both Senator Heitkamp and Governor Schaefer not only advocate for bridging political divides, but also live by those principles. Their stories and insights from this event at Concordia College underscore a vital message for all of us. In the face of division, civility, respect, and a focus on the common good can pave the way for a more united and productive society. In times of division, let us remember the power of civility, the importance of dialogue, and the unyielding potential of collective action towards the common good. In future episodes of Main Street, we'll bring you more from this important event.
This is Dakota Daybook for April 9th. Few critters in North Dakota might be as storied as the black-footed ferret, an endangered and mischievous species. Poisonings targeting prairie dogs led to the ferret's demise in the early 20th century, and it was thought to be extinct until a small group was found in Wyoming in 1981. The ferret's comeback through captive breeding had been decades in the making. The ferret has a long, light-colored body and black eye mask. They eat prairie dogs and historically roamed in western North Dakota. Theodore Roosevelt, who hunted and ranched in the Badlands in the 1880s, wrote about the ferret saying, "It is a most bloodthirsty little brute, feeding on all small animals and ground birds. It will readily master a jackrabbit, will kill very young fawns if it finds them in the mother's absence, and works extraordinary havoc in a dog town, as it can follow the wretched little beast down into the burrows." In 1909, several historians and scientists and their native guides embarked on a three-week trip down the Missouri River from Fort Berthold to Fort Rice. Along the way, they snared and killed a black-footed ferret as it poked out of a prairie dog hole. They took the specimen to Bismarck, where it was identified as a black-footed ferret, considered even then to be a very rare animal. The men saw two other ferrets in the dog town, killing prairie dogs right and left. On this date in 1951, Bismarck Tribune readers learned that a Mott area farmer had recently killed a black-footed ferret with a pitchfork. The ferret had attacked his dog. The farmer spotted a second ferret at the time, but that one didn't attack. The killed ferret was mounted at the University of Iowa and is now held by the State Historical Society of North Dakota. In 1954, officials of Theodore Roosevelt National Park planned to bring in 3 pairs of black-footed ferrets from South Dakota to keep prairie dogs in check. Following their near extinction, black-footed ferrets are making a comeback. In 2021, on the Standing Rock Reservation in South Dakota, federal and tribal wildlife officials released 28 ferrets, followed by another release in 2022. Today's Dakota Daybook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Hey, it's Main Street's Ashley Thornburg, and that's it for this Tuesday edition. Popping in here to tell you about what's coming up tomorrow, a conversation about identity and how where we're from, how we eat, how we dance, tells the story of who we are. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.